Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian. This is Insight number 139. It's Friday, the 15th of October, 2010, as we record this. I'm Steve Litchfield, and with me, I have the main man.
Rafe Blanford.
Yes, Ewan is off in America somewhere doing some blog expo thing. David Gilson is a bit poorly at the moment still, so our thoughts go out to him. So just Rafe and I, but we've got plenty of bits and pieces to chat over. Starting off with a brand new device. It's with a remarkably little hullabaloo. Nokia have launched the C503, their new naming scheme, something which we'll come back to, I suspect, in the near future. It's a lower mid-range touchscreen phone, traditional slab form factor, yet another of the same old, but again, looking at down at the lower end of the price range, I guess also looking at towards Asia and perhaps the non-UK market, certainly. Expected retail price quoted in euros is 170 before the usual taxes and subsidies. I suspect on pay-as-you-go in UK money, we'd be looking at something like £120. It runs S65th edition, so it's not one of the new Symbian 3 devices, but it does have 3G, Wi-Fi, GPS, and digital compass, and 5-megapixel camera, and it's tri-band 3G, full maps, full store, full navigation. Still a lot of phone for the money, but perhaps people might be, listeners to this podcast might be a bit disappointed about the fact that it's one of the old school devices. Rafe, what's your take on the C503?
Well, I agree with what you said, that people may at first glance be a bit disappointed. But having said this, this has all the key hardware. You know, it's the little things like the extra bands on the 3G and also the digital compass, so you can use it with the augmented reality type application to get the full kind of GPS experience as well. So, you know, this is actually pretty good value for what it is. It's capable of doing anything that the higher-end devices are doing in terms of pure function. Obviously, it may not be quite as smooth and it doesn't have the graphics capability, it's not running Symbian 3, but that doesn't mean it's not, you know, quite a capable device. And to my mind, this is very much like kind of a replacement, if you like, for the 5800, which, as we all know, has been an incredibly popular device and is still selling well indeed. You know, it kind of fits in between something like the 5250, which is, you know, available at an even cheaper price. That's 115 euros, I think it is. And the C601, which is, you know, the first of the Symbian 3 devices at 260 euros. You know, and people need to understand that it's important to have offerings at those different price points, because as you go further down the market, people become increasingly sensitive to price. I also think, you know, just looking at the design of this, I haven't seen one in person, of course, but this kind of duotonal, this dual tone design colouring actually looks quite stylish. And I think I'm right in saying there's a mixture of some metallics and some plastics on this device. And so, you know, it's got a feeling of, you know, just looking slightly better than the kind of blocky things we've seen from the 5800 and the 5230. It's certainly a little bit thinner. And so it just is a slightly more contemporary design. And I think that's a nice touch. And it may seem a little shallow to be talking about design in one sense, but at this point in the market, actually that kind of thing does have an important factor on the sales. So yes, I think it's an interesting device. As Steve says, it is kind of the third C5 device we've seen. We've already seen the C500, that's kind of the traditional non-touchscreen candy bar phone, and that's, you know, again pretty cheap. I think that comes in around 130 euros or so, something like that. And the C502, which is really a similar phone, but with the TD SCDMA bands for the Chinese market. So this, you know, is touchscreen, rather different to what we've seen before. But the point about the new naming scheme is that it's not meant to be everything the same type of device within a family. It's roughly the same kind of price point that people would look for, the similar level of functionality, and certainly that's borne out in the specifications.
Yeah.
Just to point out one small thing on the specs is it's actually running a 600 megahertz single core processor, which I believe is a slight upscale from 434, which we've traditionally seen. I'm not actually sure whether this is a different processor or it's just been overclocked a little bit. I would have to look into that in more detail. But certainly, you know, combining pretty much everything you need from a hardware point of view, okay, it's slightly behind in the software terms, but, you know, that's pretty common on other platforms. You know, you see the Android 1.6 devices on the lower-end Android devices and, you know, the choice of colours. So, not much fanfare to this launch, but actually, I suspect it will still do pretty well, even if it will be ignored by a lot of people listening to this podcast or indeed, you know, the tech scene in general.
I was disappointed that the screen was resistive. We're still talking about something that's well over a £100 and getting on towards £200 if you were to buy a SIM free, even if it could be about 130 pairs you go. And the X6 kind of, that really worked, having a capacitive screen with S65th edition with the latest kinetic scrolling and the latest slight tweaks to S65th edition. I was disappointed for a device being launched at the end of 2010. They didn't also put in the X6's capacitive touchscreen.
Well, that's true, and certainly for the Western markets, I think that's true. But what you said earlier was this is maybe not for the European and the American markets, maybe for the Asian markets. And actually, there, okay, resistive touchscreen does make more sense because of the handwriting recognition and the input issues around that. You know, capacitive versus resistive, that debate's going to go on and on. Obviously, there's a cost dimension to it. And I do think on something like browsing, capacitive is clearly superior. But a lot of time, if you're used to a resistive screen, it's not all as bad as it's made out to be. And as I say, particularly for the input mechanism, resistive is generally superior if you're obviously doing the handwriting recognition because of the extra accuracy.
Yeah, there's also actually that one factor which people don't really consider much, which is that the capacitive screens are a real pain when it's wet or humid.
Absolutely.
And I presume, again, if you're in Asia, and I've got a friend who's over there at the moment, and she's saying it's unbelievable how humid it is in some of these countries. And the clothes she brought over with her from Europe, they're all just going mouldy in her drawers because the air is so humid. And in that sort of environment, trying to use a capacitive touchscreen when there's just sweat and moisture, that just confuses the heck out of the touchscreen. So, again, I guess resistive might work better in a very damp environment.
It's always the case with these specifications that you have to look quite closely, carefully, and there's always, you know, more than one side to the story.
One other device, which is pretty new, I guess it qualifies now as a mid-term review as opposed to a long-term review. 2.5 weeks now we've had with the Nokia N8, Rafe and myself, and we've really put it through its paces, I think. Up on the site now, we've got 4 of our review parts, totaling a massive 13,000 words, covering everything on the hardware, the camera, multimedia, gaming, messaging, email, and web. So do go and read that. There's a lot there, so get yourself a cup of coffee and settle down. There's a few disappointments, I have to say. Along with all the positives, there are some signs that Nokia just kind of haven't finished all the firmware and haven't joined all the dots. For example, this is an example from today as we record this. People will know I've been moaning about the absence of Share Online, which was Nokia's previous way of sharing photos and videos up to services like Flickr, Vox, and so on. And yes, you can install the free Pixel Pipe, but just out of the box, there's no traditional way of sharing full quality pictures on the N8. So you think, okay, well, no problem. Let's think laterally. Most of these upload sites like Flickr, YouTube, and so on have an email address, a special personalized email address. You can just email a photo to that personal email address, and the photo will appear on the site with the title as the subject of your email and the description as the body of the email. Fine and dandy. But the email on the N8 all relies on the Nokia messaging backend, which is fine, and it works fine for normal, you know, Hotmail, Gmail, various setting up your own custom mailboxes. All works to the Nokia messaging backend, and it handles it, and it's pseudo push email. Very little goes wrong. The N8 has really got that down to a fine art. Sign up is really super quick, but okay, you take a photograph in your N8. It's a 2.3 megabyte JPEG of some nice sunset. Right, I'll bang this up to my Flickr account. You type in the address or put that in your contacts, and you send off the email. A minute or two later, you come back and it has an error message. Attachment too big. You cannot send attachments of more than 2 megabytes. And this is absolutely ridiculous. And it seems to be a limitation within the Nokia messaging backend. And if you just back right out of Nokia messaging and set up an email account the old-fashioned way by refusing the Nokia messaging terms of service and say, look, I've got an IMAP 4 server, I want to use it, please, and just set up as a traditional IMAP 4 email account, you can then send an email with a 10 megabyte attachment or as large as you want with no problems whatsoever. So given that the N8 is a content creation device, creating, you know, videos with many megabytes and certainly photos with 2, 3, maybe even 4 megabytes in extreme cases with lots of detail, then surely, given the fact there's no Share Online, to then artificially cripple the email systems so that it can't handle those attachments for sending your media off to these online services just seems absolutely crazy. Is this something that Nokia, do you think, would be aware of and fix, Rafe, or are we stuck with it?
Well, I would certainly hope they'd fix it because I agree this doesn't make any sense at all. I didn't actually come across this during testing because I guess all the photos I had sent via email were under 2 megabytes in size. As Steve suggested, it rather depends on the amount of detail. But I actually tested this by having an artificially large file. And yes, it does seem completely nuts to me. And I would imagine that this is something that's relatively easy to solve with a setting on the back end. Worst case scenario, I guess it might need an update of the client. And I would certainly hope they're aware of it, and there'll be some noise on it. And if they're not, I think I'll let them know myself, because you know, this is one of those frustrations that you think, couldn't someone have checked that out during the testing period? But you know, these sort of things do slip through, and as Steve suggests, there it's actually more prevalent because of the absence of any kind of share online or post straight to social service in the actual device. I've since had Pixel Pipe installed, so I've been doing it that way. But yes, I agree, a lot of people will be sending it by email, and actually a lot of people just want to send one photo off by email. And certainly in the cases of images, you can't really see why there's any reason it couldn't, if it can't say, right, I don't want to send an attachment that big, it could at least offer to resize it, as it does for the MMS messages. It will resize those dynamically for you, so it could at least do, as a bare minimum, it could do that for email, even though most of the time I would actually want to send the original full-size image.
Yeah, it should be borne in mind that we're complaining about some relatively minor things here. They're important if you're trying to do that particular task, but in the grand context of a device with a lifespan of, say, 2 years of firmware updates, improvements, just think, we've used this example before, but just think what the N95 went through over the 2 years from its launch. Think what the 5800 had gone through. The 5800 is a totally different device to that which was first launched just over 2 years ago, and I fully expect the same sort of support for Nokia behind the N8. Yes, we're complaining about all sorts of little odds and ends, and I'm absolutely sure they're going to be addressing them and fixing them one by one, and by the end of this year, certainly, I think half of our gripes will be null and void.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the good things about all of these Symbian 3 devices, they're running on the common software platform, so we're actually likely to see more frequent updates than we ever have before on the Nokia devices. And of course, all the servers and the things are independent and so can be updated independently without any trouble. The software update will allow for that, as well as it, happening in big firmware upgrades. I think a good example of this is the web browser, which is another area which I think you could probably describe as a disappointment. I mean, it's interesting, there's been a lot of noise around this particular area, and I think part of that is because there are no big changes to the web browser in terms of the software. There is actually a big difference in that you've got the extra RAM and the processor, and so it's generally quicker loading and rendering pages than before. And also, for those who've been on resistive touchscreens, that step up to capacitive, particularly with regard to navigating around a page, is a big improvement. And I said in the review this week that actually I thought that was a bigger change than anything you could achieve in software. But so the browser is as it was before, and lest we forget, this is still a pretty capable browser, and if you stick to mobile sites, you really won't notice anything at all. If you go onto some big websites, and we're talking BBC News, so 1.5 megabytes plus when you're downloading it, there are some slowdowns. To be fair, this does happen on other platforms as well, but Steve, would you say it's reasonable to say that the basic S60 web browser, as it is on the N8, doesn't really measure up to what you get on kind of the higher end, at least, Android devices and something like the iPhone?
Well, possibly, but I think people are kind of losing track of the fact, I mean, this is endemic to our modern technological society, they're losing track of exactly what is being done here. If you think about a big site like the BBC News or desktop version, or Engadget Mobile.com, which is another favourite one people bring up, or BoingBoing.net, one of these sites, you're talking of megabytes of JavaScript and HTML code, all of which have to be downloaded and then individually parsed through, and all the logical structures and the imaging structures and the data structures all set up in RAM, all rendered or manipulated. And that's not before you've even downloaded any images or flash content. There's an awful lot of work going on here, and to get through that work, you need basic grunt, you need basic horsepower, you need a fast processor and efficient code. Now, the processor on the N8, for example, isn't as fast as those in the Android world, and that does have an effect. It's also the first version effect of the Nokia's the first version of WebKit in that era of sort of 2008-2009. We're now seeing WebKit engines that have been drastically overhauled and used in some other devices, and we're going to start to see that, I suspect, on the new browser coming from Nokia in a month or so's time. But Yes, it's a slightly underpowered, but it's doing an awful lot of work. And I think people get blasé about it. On their desktop PCs with 2.4 gigahertz processors and multiple cores and OODL and 4 gigabytes of RAM, they go to a site and think, okay, well, it loads in 4 seconds. I expect my phone to be able to do it in 8. Completely ignoring the fact that the phone has something like a tenth the resources of the desktop, and therefore it should take 10 times as long. And to me, it's actually a miracle that some of these sites actually load on the N8 at all. I, for one, I'm not a huge browser of desktop class sites on a phone screen. I just think this is using the wrong tool for the wrong job. If I'm on a phone and I want to bring up pages of information on the web, then I want to use a mobile site if possible, and to use a low bandwidth or lower bandwidth version, or, again, to try and reduce the resource requirements and to try and reduce the bandwidth. And I wouldn't even think of going to, for example, Engadgetmobile.com, the full site, on a phone browser. Why would you? Surely you'd use a mobile solution.
Yeah, no, I think this is a good example of how the different sort of use cases or the different ways people do things actually has a big impact on how they perceive things. I'm not actually sure that the process or the RAM is a limitation on the browser. In this case, I think it's almost entirely down to the software, and in particular, it's the JavaScript engine on the current browser that slows things down. I think we mentioned in the last podcast that, you know, there is a new version of the browser on the way, and we expect that to be delivered in kind of the first major firmware update for the N8. We don't have any, you know, Nokia hasn't announced anything formally, but we're pretty sure that that's going to happen. So it'll be interesting sort of doing some benchmarking once that comes out. I guess the other area that we should talk about in terms of, you know, one that's generated a lot of discussion in terms of a weakness and whether it is one for the N8 is the text input. Steve, I know we talked about this earlier in the week at sort of outside of the podcast, and we've been looking at particularly the sort of auto correction on the N8. Have you sort of changed your view a little bit from your first part of the review where you were fairly critical of it?
Absolutely. If you go into the input options when you're actually editing a text field or a text screen on the N8, you can activate or deactivate prediction. You think, okay, well, I understand that. If you go into settings, you then get extra degrees of detail. You can turn word auto completion on or off, and you can change the text correction level, and you can change the text correction mode to show the suggestion or to show the entered word. And that's the bit that, going down into these detailed settings, that's the bit where you can really customize it, how it works, how you want it to work. So, for example, you start typing a word, ignominious, and you start type it in, and it shows you get it wrong, and it shows the real word as the suggestion, and then what you actually typed actually in line in the text. And you think, okay, well, now then do I then have to tap on the corrected word and then, you know, lift my finger from the keyboard to tap on the word and then it gets entered? No, you simply go into the settings and change the text correction mode to show the suggestion rather than the entered word. So it toggles the way it works. Again, with the word auto completion, I tend to run it with it off, but to have the suggestion, the predictive text turned on. And that way I can just type in sort of iPhone, Android, OS style, just tapping away, not worrying too much about whether I hit absolutely every key and relying on the software to do most of the work for me and to enter the right word without stopping to ask me and wait for my tap on its suggestion. It just enters the suggestion. There are a few common words that, I mean, the word the was being recognized wrongly at first, as I think I mentioned last week, but even that seems to be improving. Like, there is definitely some learning going on with this module. As it learns the words you enter, as it learns the misspellings that it corrects, it must log these somewhere and think, okay, well, I won't make that mistake again. I'll put that word in next time. So it's definitely been impressing me. It's definitely been getting better and better and better. And it does get to the point where these devices with the large screens, I found this on the Samsung i9 10HD, that you've got enough dexterity and control over which letters get entered. And there's just enough intelligence behind the software, certainly on the N8, that you really don't miss a hardware keyboard that much. The space for your thumbs is actually a lot wider than on something like the Nokia E72, and people were quite happy with that keyboard, albeit that was hardware. So on the whole, I've been increasingly impressed, I think I'd phrase it. It's not as good as the iPhone's auto correction. I would say it's not far off what's on the Android devices, and it's certainly a heck of a lot better than things like the Nokia 5800 and X6, where you had a smaller screen and no word writing aids whatsoever. So cautious thumbs up.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. Indeed, on the learning side of things, I've definitely notice that coming. It does make a big difference. I think we should probably be fair and say that a certain amount of it is you get familiar with a device after you use it for a little while. You know, you get muscle memory coming in. But certainly I've noticed with the sort of auto correction turned on, as Steve suggests, you can actually mistype pretty much every word in a sentence, but it will still auto correct everything and get it right. And so I still miss a physical keyboard, and so I'd look forward to something like the E7, but I was able to enter text pretty quickly. Interestingly, the C7 actually has the text settings set differently by default to the ones that Steve has just suggested, and so when you first get it out of the box, it feels like it's got better text entry. It's also got a slightly different vibromotor, which at least to my fingers feels like a slightly more responsive feedback. Now, that's pretty subjective, but yes, also from my point of view, the landscape QWERTY keyboard is much improved, and I would actually say it's probably slightly better than the Android devices that I've tried, but obviously there is a fair amount of variation between devices there. Yes, maybe not quite up to the iPhone standards yet, but it sort of depends on where you're using and what you get used to, of course. The other dimension, I think, to text input we should mention briefly is in portrait mode. A lot of people have been complaining about the absence of a mini QWERTY in portrait mode. It's going to be more difficult to achieve this on the Symbian device, of course, because there is a slightly different aspect ratio to some of its competitors, i.e. the actual portrait mode has a slightly thinner screen than elsewhere.
Yeah.
And instead, we've got this alphanumerical, the T9 style ITU keyboard. I'm actually rather a fan of this because I think it makes for better one-handed use, but I would like to see the choice come in. So if people want it, they can have the QWERTY keyboard. Now, this will actually happen when the swipe software becomes available for Symbian 3, which I understand isn't very far off now. And you will then get the mini QWERTY. But is this a bit of a storm in a teacup? I mean, how important would you say is mini QWERTY in this sort of portrait mode, Steve?
It's obviously seen as important by people from the tech media because they're coming from a world where they've been used to playing with iPhones and playing with Android devices, all of which have it. But I absolutely agree. I mean, Nokia are here looking to people who are familiar with traditional phones, traditional keypads, and are also used to previous Nokia touchscreen phones. They're used to having a phone-like narrow device that sits in the hand. They can use one-handed by tapping with their thumb on a predictive, you know, as you say, an ITU, whatever that stands for, a keypad, and they're playing up for backwards compatibility with that. I find absolutely no problem going from something like the Nokia N86 or the N95 and then picking up the N8 and using it one-handed in exactly the same mode with the thumb going to more or less exactly the same points. And I always find the portrait QWERTY keyboards on the various devices I try out, they're always rather fiddly, and I gratefully switch them into landscape so I got the wider keyboard. Having said that, yes, it is. It's a bit of a checkpoint, it's a check mark. They can say, yes, I've got portrait QWERTY, tick, and that will appease certainly a lot of the reviewers who are coming to the device from the perspective of other platforms. So I did hear a rumor, Rafe, that Symbian 3 does actually support portrait QWERTY, but it just wasn't enabled for the N8.
Yes,
maybe it'll make an appearance in the future.
Yes, you're absolutely right then. I did actually talk to a Nokia product manager about this sort of specific thing at Nokia World, and they said basically the portrait QWERTY wasn't in a good enough state that we felt happy putting it on the device, but they are still working on it, and so I wouldn't be at all surprised to see it make a reappearance at some point. And what you were mentioning there about one-handed use, I actually think tends to get underestimated in device reviews. A lot of the time, I think people sit at desks writing these reviews and they've got two hands available. But out in the real world, the majority of the time, you've actually only got one hand available to interact with the phone. And
you might be standing on one leg under an umbrella in the rain.
Indeed, yes. So I was testing that particular scenario in the review, partly to make a point. But I think this is something that, as I say, gets overlooked because, being able to use the device one-handed is a real boon. And I think this is something that Nokia really is supreme at. Now, this is partly, I think, down to Symbian 3's more menu-driven interface, but it does come into play in the text input. And personally, from a personal point of view, and this is obviously a subjective opinion, this is, to an extent, has put me off Android devices and the iPhone, is that the fact you need to get full, easy use out of them, you need to use two hands. And so trying to use one hand to put things in a QWERTY keyboard in portrait mode is virtually impossible. And to my mind, if you've got two hands, you can switch it into landscape mode. And a lot of the time, that's going to work better for text entry. You actually get the wider screen, you get the wider keyboard, and you get faster. So I think this one-handed thing, you know, people actually need to pay more attention to it in reviews, because to say you're on the bus, you're on the tube, walking down the street, you've got one hand, and that's the way people use it, not sitting at a desk. I mean, these are called mobile devices after all, so they're for use on the move. So just a little rant from me there about the frustration that I don't see more discussion of this one-handed usage scenario sort of in reviews and in sort of general discussion.
I refer you back to a number of editorials on the subject from my good self on All About Symbian last few years. The Nokia C7 has started not only started shipping, as we reported last week. Rafe actually has one in his sweaty hands. So can you just give a teaser of your first impressions of the Nokia C7?
Well, you probably remember from earlier podcasts, I was rather enamoured of this handset from Nokia World. And I got to say, the design of this thing really is absolutely gorgeous. The way it fits into the hand, it's just that little bit smaller than the N8, and it's you know, quite a bit thinner as well. Rather than having kind of quite bulgy sides and a big bezel as the N8 does, it's sort of a much kind of slicker handset. You know, there's a smaller bezel, and the curves, because it's not a kind of a unibody bit of aluminium, it's just a bit, it's that little bit smaller. And it's actually interesting, it doesn't look entirely in the traditional Nokia design school. If I had to describe it, I'd say it's sort of halfway between Nokia and, in a sense, so kind of curvy Samsungs that we saw a lot of in the last couple of years. And Samsung's design language has changed a little bit now, but I think people will know what I mean. But there are a couple of things that, you know, immediately spring out at you. You know, there's no hump on the back for the camera, and so it's an EDOF lens. We'll talk a little bit about that once I've had a chance to try it out. But there's also real keys for the send and end key, something I'm a big fan of. It makes it much easier to, you know, answer a call and do basic things. And actually, as we've mentioned in passing for the N8, those keys are actually used as shortcuts for other things, so I'm very glad to have them back. Other than that, you know, the functionality is very much the same as the N8. The big difference really is the camera. You know, you've got the same size screen, you've got the same kind of software capabilities. In fact, you know, the software it's running is virtually identical. There are a few setup differences. I've already talked about the text input one, and there's rearranged widgets on the home screen, and a few extra bits of software bundled with it, probably reflecting the fact that the C7 came out just that little bit later than the N8. But you, as I say, other than that, the hardware is pretty much identical. So it is down to the design. I've got the sort of black graphite one, and it does look very attractive, very slim. Having not used it that much, I, you know, can't go into that much detail, but I suspect it'll be a very similar software experience to the N8. But if I had to pick one right now, actually, I'd have a pretty hard time doing it. If it wasn't for the camera on the N8, which, you know, I do like, I actually think the C7's a more attractive and more pocketable device, and so certainly gets the thumbs up from me. And I'll be reporting on this more in the next few days to sort of tell you what my first impressions are. But you know,
I gather the C7's battery is removable, unlike the N8.
Yes, that's a very good point. That you open up the battery cover on the C7, and as you say, it's removable. But you actually look at it and you think, where on earth is the actual sort of hardware for the phone? Because the battery takes up, you know, about half the phone, and then there's the various SIM card slots, which always take up a bit of room, you know, the camera module. And as far as I can see, you know, most of the hardware the phone is being, you know, I guess it's crammed under the battery, but there's not much space there until you get to the screen, the top and the bottom of the phone. And so it really is a marvel of miniaturization. You know, Nokia's industrial engineers and industrial designers have done a fantastic job on this handset. And in one sense, I think it's more impressive than, as I say, than the N8, just because it's that little bit smaller, but got all the same stuff in it, and put in such an attractive package. You know, one of those complaints about you know, battery covers is they always lead to a bit of squeak, but you know, this thing feels absolutely rock solid. I mean, it's I was just playing with it in my hand as we're talking about it, and it's solid enough that I actually kind of forgot that it was a removable battery. It feels that much of a one piece. And so incredibly impressive on the design front. And I actually think this is going to be the handset out of all the Symbian 3 ones. This is going to attract an awful lot of people, just because that design, when it's sitting on the shelf and when you pick it up for the first time, works really well. And whereas the N8 is kind of a blocky masculine design, I think the C7 will probably have broader appeal. Maybe the C6 will still outsell it given the cheaper price point, but certainly in sort of the Western markets, in places like Europe, I think the C7 is going to do incredibly well amongst people who are already Nokia fans. You know, it isn't necessarily going to transfer over from Android and iPhone users, but you know, if you're on an an existing Nokia smartphone, you know, maybe you're an old guy on the N95 or the N73, something like that. Or if you're on the 5800 and are looking to maybe just pay a little bit more, the C7 is definitely going to be the device for you.
Yeah, yes, it's worth looking back and just look at the size of some of the devices we've had in the past. I'm just thinking of things like the 7650, the 3650, even going up to the N95 itself, which we remember when the N95 came out, we thought, wow, how the heck have they packed all those gadgets into the one phone? And now if you take an N95 Classic out of the shelf, you think, wow, it's enormous. You can't remember how thick these devices used to be. And I'm not saying thinness is everything, but the micro miniaturization and the industrial design on the N8 and C7 in particular, I think is just absolutely stunning. And I'm very much looking forward to having a hands-on with the C7 myself.
Absolutely. I mean, just to reinforce that point, I've got the N97 and the C7 sitting next to me on the desk. And okay, the N97's got the keyboard, but you could actually front profile of them is pretty much the same. You know, they both got the 3.5-inch touchscreen. But in the space I've got the N97, you could stack two C7s on top of each other and you'd get to roughly the same size as the N97. And, you know, similarly, if you get something like, I don't know, the X6, I'll just put this next to it. And again, you've got the same thing. Of course, the X6 is actually on a slightly smaller 3.2-inch touchscreen, but it's probably about a third thicker than the C7, and given that's a device from, you know, only, well, less than a year ago, I guess, it really is impressive and stands out. So it's, you know, you're getting actually what is a pretty big touchscreen in a relatively small device, and you know, with the capacitive touchscreen and everything that Symbian 3 delivers, it really is a fantastic little package. And I think I'm going to have to be careful here, because I'm sound like a fan of the device already, and we'll have to try and be objective as possible. But I do think this is a device that really stands out from some of the competition as well. So, you know, given the price point, we're talking about, I think, €350. I'm seeing it selling in the UK for sort of £310 or so. And as we all know, that price will drop. And if you put that up against other smartphones in that price range, it really does stand out. I mean, it's no exaggeration to say, you know, you can take the C7 and put it against phones that are a couple of £100 more expensive and it won't shame itself. You put it up against phones that are in the similar price league, and I think it's significantly ahead. And we've said before that Symbian 3 in the mid-tier has a real advantage because it's, you know, identical to what you're getting at the high end. And I think this will be really borne out in the C7. So looking at it from a comparative point of view, I think that may be one of the C7's big strengths.
Yeah. Before we finish this podcast, I just wanted a shout out for some of the new 3D games appearing for the N8 and C7, other Symbian 3 phones. The Nokia very handily put some kind of style guide on most of these games that are appearing on the Obvious Store. You won't see them if you've got the older Symbian devices, you know, the S60 5th edition. But if you've got a new device, go look in the Obvious Store, because many of the titles now end in the words HD, which is a bit of a misnomer because the screen resolution is identical to that of every other S60 5th edition device for the last 2 years. But leaving aside that minor pedantic point, most of these titles, GT Racing, Motor Academy, Rally Master Pro, Guitar Rock, the full name of that is Raging Thunder 2, there's Avatar, there's Angry Birds, there's a whole range. There's Monopoly 3D, Monopoly HD, there's Tetris HD. All of these titles are highly recommended. They're a world different from the little cut-down Java versions we've had of these games on previous Symbian phones over the last couple of years, because there hasn't been the graphical oomph to run them. All of a sudden, we've got decent hardware, iPhone-class graphics acceleration, and boy, some of these games developers are really taking use of it. So many of these titles are over 100 megabytes in size, which will give you an idea of the sort of graphics they're using and throwing around. Full digital soundtrack, fluid motion, capacitive touch, accelerometer aware, really, really recommended. We've alluded to a few of them in the gaming part of our N8 review. GT Racing in particular is my favourite. It's a stunning motor racing game, which is up with many of the titles on the iPhones.
If you want to start somewhere, then start with that. Did you have a chance to try Monopoly or Tetris HD?
I haven't tried over those, but I have tried Avatar Football and some of the racing games. And yes, they really do stand out. In particular, the ones which have the hundreds of megabyte size tend to come with pretty good audio tracks as well. And if you plug that into an HDTV using the HDMI out, you do get a gaming experience, which I would say is sort of, let's say, equivalent to second generation console, you know, very impressive indeed. And, you know, it always has been, you know, up until now, people have said, you know, there's a weakness on the Symbian gaming side of things. And certainly that's been true in terms of these sort of graphically intensive games, maybe not so much on the casual gaming front. But now with sort of 10, I guess it's getting towards 20 of these titles available in Ovi Store, for people picking up these devices, actually the gaming experience is just as good on these Symbian devices as we're getting on Android and iPhone. And so that is a kind of differentiation point has pretty much disappeared. I haven't really seen many people talking about that in the sort of N8 reviews we've seen, but I think that's actually quite a significant factor, because I know some people, you know, talk about app stores and all of that, and actually I think a lot of it comes down to the games that you can download. They seem to be one of the most popular things that people download, and so that, you know, differentiator has pretty much at a stroke disappeared. Clearly there aren't as many games available in this kind of mold for Symbian 3 yet, but given that we've had so many in sort of quick succession, I suspect we're going to keep seeing more of these, and certainly from the big guys, the likes of Gameloft and others, and EA, I suspect what we'll see is they'll launch them on one platform and rapidly roll them out to other platforms. They're almost certainly doing this in a, you know, agnostic way, in that they've got some kind of engine running underneath it. And partly that's, you know, allowed by the fact that, you know, Symbian 3 has this, you know, the later thing in terms of POSIX and all of that. And if you get to a low enough level, these things are relatively common, because they're all running off the ARM chipset architecture and they're all using OpenGL for the graphics. And so there's kind of that standardization in gaming, which you don't actually get so much in the application world. So I've been, you know, as someone who's not really a gamer, I've been really impressed by the gaming capabilities of this device. It's kind of crept up on me. And as I say, when you couple that with the kind of the HDMI out, it does work quite well as an entertainment device. And of course, most of the time you're not going to be doing it on a big TV screen, but it's a good way to show off. But I've also been pretty impressed with the battery life on this front. I found that it's, you know, does pretty well even on a sort of 4 or 5 hour gaming session. I haven't done that all in one go, I hasten to add, but when I was doing some traveling, I probably played a couple of hours of games while waiting for a plane, and then a bit more watching video. It didn't have as sort of a bad effect on the battery as I was really expecting it to do so. So I think that's probably testament to the power management on the Broadcom graphics chipset. And people have looked at, you know, the base specs of something like the N8 and said, oh no, that's an old-fashioned processor and that's that graphics doesn't seem very good. But I think the benchmarks certainly bear it out, that it is producing or able to push through pixels and stuff equal to the iPhone. In fact, if you look at the benchmarks, you'll see that the iPhone and Android does better in some areas and vice versa. I think the Galaxy S, which is it Hummingbird in the core, is sort of probably the premium one at the moment. But even there, the Broadcom chipset's actually beating that in some areas. So I think you can probably say within sort of 10-20% mark, all of these high-end phones are capable of producing impressive 3D graphics to about the same level. And the differences you'll see are actually probably more down to the individual software programmers rather than the capability of the hardware. And to be able to say, you know, Nokia gaming in that same sentence, when we think back to sort of some of the crashes and the disaster area that was Engage, I think that's a pretty impressive achievement and something that, you know, people maybe should pay just that little bit more attention to. Do you think that's a fair comment, Steve?
Absolutely. And I still like to see some of those classic Engage games come back in the Ovi Store. There are several of my favourites. For example, the Tiger Woods Golf, which I was utterly addicted to on the Engage, on things like the N96. And then it did, the sort of Engage died a death, and the title never reappeared in native Symbian form. We just had the Poxy Java version, and now we've got the decent hardware. Then there are all sorts of titles. I'm sure you and Mr. Ewan Spence, if he was here, was to name a few of his favourites from the Engage franchise, which really need a reappearance in, quote, HD form here in the Ovi Store.
Well, you think
devices
of things like Snakes or Pathway to Glory or High Seas or some of those other really popular, you know, they were critically acclaimed but perhaps didn't get the attention they deserved, or even something like Reset Generation, which was a, you know, really beautifully implemented concept, but, you know, was probably held back by being on the Engage platform. So yes, you know, it would be interesting to see what, I imagine there's kind of IP rights around those kind of game titles, but you'd hope that Nokia might dig into some of them and bring them back, because it's certainly still doing its first gen titles. You know, we saw the Ovi Maps, I think it's quiz-based game, had come out soon, and there's a climate mission, Ovi Maps Racing, all of which, incidentally, performed pretty well on the N8. They don't push the graphic capabilities quite so much, but I'm sure we're going to see some titles from Nokia that, you know, really set the boundaries and push things back, because they like doing that as an example of what they can do. But in the meantime, there's, you know, a lot more games than I was really expecting there to be initially, that show off the N8's hardware, you know, in a really quite impressive fashion.
Yeah, yeah. We're running short of time, Rafe, so I'm going to a call halt there. We've got a few items for discussion. We'll hold over for next week, and we'll have Mr. Spence back on the podcast. We did want to talk about the Windows Phone 7 launch, in the sense of a new user interface paradigm, a new way of tying in different social networks with your contacts calendar and so on. But I'd love to talk about that next week. Also, there's Nokia Battery Monitor, which is a kind of a full-blown replacement for the humble few bars in the top right of your handset's interface, which will give you Android-like levels of detail, like 5% of your power has gone on the screen, 7% on the GPS, and so forth, since the last time the phone was started. So we'll be reporting on that on the site in the next week or so. But until then, we're going to say goodbye. You can catch us on Twitter at AAS, of course.
There's also Rafe Blanford and Steve Litchfield, as they sound on Twitter. And it's goodbye from me. And from Rafe.
Goodbye from me as well. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, catch you next week.